The Reverend Edmund Steinle, Professor of Preaching at Union Seminary, New York, is the guest lecturer for the 1969 Wenschel Lectures conducted at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri, on Wednesday, March 19, 1969.
The signboard of the Lutheran establishment just off Harvard Yard, where Pastor Steinle was campus chaplain. And it's curious that I never met this good man until a little over a year ago, but I had gotten well acquainted with his mind. He wrote an amazingly sound article in Lutheran Quarterly many years ago entitled, Preaching is the Word of God Made Relevant. And he was a little ahead of his time with what he said there, and that article introduced me to P.T. Forsyth and H.H. Farmer. The Army has developed an apothegm which says, if you can't do it, teach it. And this has been applied, I have discovered uncomfortably, to teachers of homiletics, teachers of preaching. But this man outwitted the apothegm because he could really do it. One of the sagas of the radio industry is how he was picked to be the preacher on the Protestant Hour on the East Coast, and he was well known as a preacher, and we of the teaching craft were really charmed that here was a man who was willing to bear the heat and burden of the day and start teaching the stuff. But what are his prime credentials, even more than his works which he has published in this splendid series, The Pastor's Paperback Library of Fortress, which he edits? I think is the word that comes through to us from his students and his colleagues at Union, what he really does and what he means in that school. It is asking an awful lot for just one day and two quick lectures to do this for us, but I hope that some of Edmund Steinle's meaning to his time will slip off on us. We have him on our heart, especially as he stands under a great burden in these days, and we're so grateful that he could come to see us. So, the first of the two lectures of Dr. Edmund Steinle.
Great joy for me to be here. It's the first time I've been to this renowned institution. I have heard of it all my life. I've often wondered about it. I've stood in some awe of it. And now I am here. It looks like just any other campus. The differences may not be quite so apparent, and I may learn of them as I stay here during the day. I want to speak on two subjects, both of which are, as you will discover, a kind of dialogue with so much of the material that has been coming out in the past 5 years or so on the renewal of the church. If you've been reading much of this stuff, you have discovered that they have very little to say about preaching, and what little they do have to say frequently is quite disturbing, at least to me in my understanding of what preaching is. In that dialogue, we ought to begin with the question of whether there still is a place for the pulpit. Because this is being seriously questioned, whether the monological form, even though it may be dialogical in character, whether the monological form still can carry any freight in a world like ours of mass media, multimedia, and all the rest of it. I'm assuming that in this place, We are pretty much committed to the idea that there still is a place for the pulpit, though at times I suspect we may wonder what its place really is. So I'm not going to debate the pros and cons, though I think it would be appropriate, as to whether there still is a place for the monological sermonic form. But I want to go on to beyond that in this first lecture to the focus of contemporary preaching, its major thrust in view of the world in which we're living, and then this evening discuss more particularly. This morning I'm going to be talking about preaching, not a single sermon, but the total thrust of preaching week after week. And then this evening speak of the fabric of the sermon itself in the light of what I say this morning. So if there still is a place for the pulpit, symbol of the sermon in its traditional setting in the context of public worship in the church of today and tomorrow, then what is supposed to happen? When a sermon is preached and heard, what is its focus? Colin Williams, in his study booklet put out by the National Council of Churches, Where in the World, has struck a fundamental note in the literature dealing with the renewal of the church when he stresses the fact that the forms of the renewed life in the church must be allowed to grow around the shapes of worldly need. In addressing ourselves, therefore, to the focus of preaching, we shall therefore need to address ourselves to the shape of worldly need to which preaching is addressed. And this simply reaffirms an old homiletical principle that the identification of human need is part and parcel of discerning what the Word of God has to say to us in any age. I also want to make clear at the outset that I believe that the pulpit is to be viewed as only one among a number of other forms and structures of the church through which the word is proclaimed and communicated, including the sacraments, small groups, the educational program, community involvement, opportunities for dialogue and discussion, music, the drama, and the dance. It is obviously not a case of either or with respect to any or all of these forms and structures, but of both and. It is my contention, moreover, that the focus of preaching is quite restricted because of its place in the context of public worship, and also, as Martin Marty has pointed out, because preaching is overburdened in an overworded world. I am not unaware of the power of the spoken word from biblical times until today as an indispensable vehicle of God's promise and demand. Faith, as you know, Luther says, is an acoustical affair. But I'm also aware of the fact that we live in an overworded world where the eyes and ears are assaulted from every side by sales pitches, propaganda, rumors, hearsay, big lies, little lies, truth, falsehood, facts, fantasy, as well as by the message from the pulpit on Sunday morning. This message not to be confused with the periodic message which sends millions of Americans to beer cans and bathrooms every 15 minutes during the evening TV set to. It's curious, we use the same word. If the preached word is to make any sense in such an overworded culture, we'd better be clear as to what should be going on when the word is preached. Let me mention, therefore, at the outset, two restrictions to be imposed on the focus of preaching, which need no theological undergirding, though theological undergirding could readily be supplied. Merely common sense. First, let there be a permanent moratorium on the institution-centered sermon. When I've made this point in other situations, some have immediately objected that this is no longer a serious problem. Well, I'm not so sure. Certainly, denominational and interdenominational bureaucracies still assume that promotional sermons will be preached in the interest of various causes and concerns of the institution, from church school curricula, church colleges, church seminaries, the stewardship, in the narrow sense of raising the budget or the interest of some special financial appeal, evangelism in the narrow sense of fattening the membership rolls, and ecumenical projects. In my own church, we have a calendar of causes. Every month is devoted to a cause in the church, and as pointed out, it is not inappropriate to preach a sermon. That would mean one each month on some cause of the church. And I have noticed that even renewal sermons too often have the strengthening of the existing institution as their target. This is not to imply, please don't misunderstand, that the institutional church, along with its proper institutional concerns, is not important. It is, obviously. Theologically, the institutional church, as I understand it, is a direct consequence of the incarnation. Our concern is simply an effort to correct, if only by silence, the impression that the pulpit is a catch-all for every cause under heaven, ecclesiastical or otherwise, and more important, to correct the impression, even if only by silence, that the church at worship is still primarily concerned with its own institutional life. Again, this is not to deny the claims of the institution, but rather to lean over backward, lest we continue to give the false impression that the church is in the world to serve itself, rather than the world for which its Lord gave his life. And the second restriction. Let us recognize the limitations of the sermon with respect to prodding the assembled community to specific social action. I'm not sure how relevant that is to the group here this morning, but it is very relevant to much that is going on in the Protestant pulpits today, certainly relevant to a lot of the students with whom I am affiliated at Union Seminary. Again, I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't know how you feel, but I believe social action is a primary concern of the church. Love the neighbor no longer can be simply a one-to-one kind of thing in a complicated world like ours. And sermons, I think, will be concerned with social issues, as I shall have opportunity to note in the presentation this evening. The question is simply whether the sermon is the most effective tool for securing action with respect to specific social and community problems. Martin Marty observes that the sermon is a frail or false instrument for most political action. Harvey Cox makes a similar observation. People simply cannot be expected to see or react responsibly to emerging social and political problems merely by hearing sermons or reading articles. Common sense would indicate that other structures would be far more effective in this regard. The seminar, the cell group, the panel discussion. Structures which provide opportunity for questions, for discussion, for clarification of complicated issues. Experiments have been carried on in some churches where a kind of open forum or dialogue sermon directing itself to a controversial social issue have replaced the more traditional monological approach. Some of this is very exciting. And I certainly believe such experiments are worth trying and may even be useful on occasion. However, I question whether the single-shot device in and of itself will actually motivate to specific action, though it may prompt thought and discussion. It is also questionable whether preaching in the form of debate can adequately carry through the quality of celebration, which should characterize, in my view of it, the community at worship. Certainly we do need further experimentation and research at this point. At any rate, a good part of the disillusionment with the pulpit, and believe me, friends, the pulpit is in deep trouble, all over the country, in every church. And I think a good part of the disillusionment with the pulpit has resulted from using it as a catch-all an all-purpose device betrayed by the cliché offered in response to any headline, cause, passing thought, book which happens along that the minister should preach a sermon about it. So let us attempt, therefore, to narrow down the specific focus of preaching in its traditional setting of common worship. And I cannot conceive of preaching apart from that setting. The focus will be determined by the nature of revelation itself. The theological accent undergirding the nature and the function of the sermon is, in my view, incarnational. God comes to man where he is, identifies himself with him where he is. And in that context makes his offer of love, which is his demand. It's been my experience in preaching this stuff for the past, what is it now, 15, 18 years. The bulk of the sermons which fail do not fail because they are poor theologically or poor biblically, but because no one in the congregation can possibly identify with what is being said in the pulpit. The world that is being presented in the pulpit is not this man's world. The language is not his language. But incarnationally understood, our Lord came to us with a face like all men's faces and became one of us. This is the wonder. And in that context of identification, spoke his word of grace and of demand. But the demand is always in the context of grace. In the acting out in history of God's saving word in the biblical record, grace is always prior in time. This is not to spit God up into a schizophrenic, acting in love at one moment and in judgment and demand at another, but so that we may understand the essential character of God as a God of grace rather than a God of wrath and judgment and law. The Exodus, therefore, precedes the giving of the law. God comes to earth in a child of Bethlehem and places himself at our disposal before the child grows up to deliver the Sermon on the Mount with its impossible demands. The invitation to the wedding precedes the demand for the wedding garment. Law is understood within the context of grace, not the reverse. Now this gives us a biblical vantage point from which to observe a strange distortion of the nature of the gospel with reference to the focus of preaching in some of the recent renewal literature. To be sure, the traditional Lutheran distinction between law and gospel can often become mechanical and wooden, but it also can still be a useful device in coming to terms with the precise focus of preaching in the current ferment in the church. Harvey Cox, for example, refers several times to the gospel as a summons to assume responsibility, to frame with his neighbor a common life suitable to the secular city. And that sounds to me like law rather than gospel. Kenneth Pfeiffer has reported that in Donald Soper's Lyman Beecher lectures, the evocation best expressed and demanded for regular churchgoers is a moral one. The moral imperative with a distinctly social emphasis. And again, the basic approach to the average churchgoer is seen as law. Even Richard Leakey, for whom I have vast admiration and respect, in his New Messages for New Beings, speaking of the sermon, writes, "A fresh understanding of the scriptures as opened by Christ and applied by the Spirit also reveals the need and the possibility of something more than the teaching accompanying the gospel, of a word addressed to the faithful in their own situation, demanding the obedience required in that situation. Such a word," he says, "is needed if there is to be any genuine obedience. The sermon," he says, "is the place where that more specific demand finds utterance." And again, the specific focus of the sermon as seen as demand, as law. One further reference. Colin Williams describes the freedom movement as a case study in the missionary structure of the church and notes the place of preaching in it. In the Monday night meetings, he says, preparing for action, there is often powerful preaching. The word brought into touch with the concrete issues before them. The biblical drama is heavily used. Here is a call for total commitment, a readiness to give one's life in the cause of true community. But a call to total commitment, if that is the basic focus of preaching, is the preaching of the law, theologically understood. I suspect that this heavy emphasis upon law rather than grace and contemporary references to the focus of preaching in the renewal of the church grows in part out of a frantic frustration, you know, regarding the place of the church in the world. What, after all, do you do with a complacent suburban or small town congregation, satisfied, self-satisfied, self-righteous, in its own comfort and security? Or what do you do with an embattled minority group itching for justice to gird them for action in a fast-moving revolutionary world, but preach the law? Get out there and fight. A call for obedience, a call for discipleship, a call for total commitment. But part of the reason for preaching the law in an age like ours may result from a curious optimism which pervades much of the recent renewal literature. Optimism not with respect to the institutional church, heaven knows, but with respect to man come of age. Harvey Cox, for example, sees the secular city as an opportunity for glorious liberation in the very anonymity and mobility, the rootlessness, so many preachers find as a cause for alarm. He writes, "Despite its pitfalls, the anonymous shape of urban life helps free a man from the law." Well, now it's perfectly true, as he points out, that in the anonymity of urban culture, far from the fishbowl of town life, modern man experiences both the terror and the delight of human freedom more acutely. The question is whether the man of our time is equipped with the maturity, which Cox assumed, with the maturity necessary to experience the delight rather than the terror. Surely if our attitude toward the wave of secularity is predominantly optimistic because of our assessment of the human situation, then the preaching will inevitably tend to the preaching of the law, because that's all you need for the individual when God is already at work redemptively out there, you know, and all is needed is that I have to be prodded into getting out there and joining up. Whether you're shamed into it or exhorted into it or called into it, the theological basis for the approach is law rather than gospel. Perhaps to counteract the optimism engendered by the possibilities within the secular revolution, it would be well to listen to Samuel Miller's sober estimate of the situation. You remember Samuel Miller, who died last year, was dean of the Divinity School at Harvard. He says, "It is thus that the double meaning of secularity makes itself known. Unity is lost." And then he illustrates that by the fact that philosophy turns from the attempt to see things whole, affirming the coherence of things, and rests content in logic, largely the syntactical logic of language. Unity, he says, is lost, and with it the coherent pattern of meaning it sustains. Yet the loss is characterized by a tremendous burst of energy expressed in the diverse forms of cultural activity in art, science, government, and religion. Secondly, he goes on, superstition is swept clean in an age of secularity. Yet with the loss of superstition, there also goes the mystery by which existence is deepened and reality in its total aspect respected. And then finally, the impact on man himself is indicated by the fact that he becomes independent in an age of secularity, achieves a notable freedom, fulfills his individuality, and yet at the same time feels himself alienated, an outsider, alone, in a world to which he does not belong. Secularity, he concludes, thus has double meanings and is in itself not a solution to the religious problem. It is in essence only the restatement of the problem. Without such a sober view of the perils as well as the promise of secularity, preaching will be heard as law, as demand, rather than as gospel, as promise. And this, in fact, is what laymen actually hear in many a sermon, according to Rule Howe. Laymen, he says, from their side, see the failure of communication to lie in the fact that the preacher's sermon, for example, on the free gift of God's love, is often heard by them simply as a new and harsher demand to be good. The preaching of grace is heard as law. The primary focus of preaching, therefore, its fundamental content, will be determined by a man's anthropology, the kind of analysis he makes of the human situation. Just as our assessment of the nature of the gospel itself will be determined by what a man believes about the human situation, the erosion of the gospel, as you well know, in the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, being watered down to a social gospel without any real sense of gospel itself, that simply was a reflection of the optimistic view of human nature, which was dominant at that time. Our view of human nature determines how we understand the gospel. So if the man to whom we preach is experiencing essentially the possibilities of a glorious liberation, as a result not only of secularity, but also because of the rapid change and the revolutionary character of our times, we will preach one thing. But if the man to whom we preach finds life more perplexing, confusing, bewildering, defeating, we will preach another. What, for example, will the preaching of the law do for Celia in T.S. Eliot's cocktail party? I want to be cured of a craving for something I cannot find, and of the shame of never finding it. But first I must tell you that I should really like to think that there's something wrong with me, because if there isn't, then there's something wrong with the world itself. And that's much more frightening. That would be terrible. So I'd rather believe there's something wrong with me that could be put right. In any case, as R.E.C. Brown has indicated in a very seminal little book on preaching, The Ministry of the Word, he's a Britisher, each minister of the word in the end must draw his own sketches and paint his own pictures of the modern situation. He will have to make countless sketches, and no single picture will satisfy him. For his knowledge of himself through self-examination and his growing knowledge of the lies led by others individually and in groups will cause him frequently to modify the conclusions he comes to about the pattern of communal living. Now we know in part, and partial knowledge only permits tentative conclusions, but tentative conclusions are sufficient for meaningful speech and action. So to find the precise focus for preaching in the world today, we need to sketch in a picture of the man to whom we preach. And the picture, as Brown points out, is tentative. It is qualified by the awareness that no single sketch or picture will fit every man. Sin, for example, wears many faces, as David Roberts has vividly indicated in his Psychotherapy and a Christian View of Man. Moreover, we are not unaware of the danger of fitting the picture to predetermined assumptions with regard to the nature of redemption. So Richard Leakey warns us of the danger of informing comparatively happy people that they're really unhappy, currently healthy people that they're really sick, and constructively busy people that they are really in despair, snuffing around in corners for cobwebs and in closets for skeletons in order to convert people
there. It's a good point. I could recall vividly a sermon which in the first 2 minutes or less, the student preacher had us in despair. Well, you can't get me in despair that quickly if I've had for the first time in my life a cup of coffee that morning that I really enjoyed. My wife was pleasant, the children were well behaved, I'd just gotten a raise, and I am not going to be put in despair in 2 minutes. You know? The failure of identification again. Recognizing the limitations and dangers, some analysis of the contemporary situation is necessary for the preacher if he is to understand the man to whom the message is addressed.
So as we have noted earlier, and I can't emphasize it enough, God comes to man where he is. And an examination of the biblical record will disclose that different human situations evoke different emphases in the word addressed to him. Amos, for example, spoke to a people in an age of peace and prosperity, an age in which religion enjoyed a tremendous boom, to a people who were proud, arrogant, corrupt, and devoted churchgoers, goers, and tigers. There's not much comfort in the book of Amos, as you know, the emphasis is on judgment. I hate, I despise your feast, I take no delight in your solemn assembly. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings, I will not accept them. Take away from me the noise of your songs, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-coming sea. To be sure, the judgment is enfolded in grace. You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. But the grace in which the judgment is declared is muted in the face of a people at ease in Zion. The prophecy of Amos, therefore, would seem to provide a very suggestive analogy for the plight of the church in America today, or much of it, and some would add, especially in suburbia. But it is applicable, I believe, only at a superficial level. The situation to which we address ourselves today seems to me to be far closer to that of the people in exile in Babylon, to whom the prophet spoke, comfort ye, my people, speak ye tenderly to Jerusalem. You can draw on your own imaginations now to provide the contemporary parallels for the situation to which the prophet addressed the message predominantly of comfort, predominantly of grace. There is law, of course, in Isaiah 40 and 55, but it is predominantly a message of hope and of grace and of comfort. Now why? A people in exile, uprooted from the land which had provided a measure of stability and security, separated from the tangible symbols of God's presence and sovereignty, the land, the hills, the temple, surrounded on every side by the very tangible and overwhelming symbols of Babylon's power and self-confidence, from the fabulous hanging gardens to the Babylonian gods which dotted the oriental sky above at night. For 50 years, I'm assuming that this section of Isaiah was written or spoken at the close of the exile. For 50 years,
that would take us back to the end of the First World War, almost two generations now. They had lived in this magnificent but flat land as exiles, sure that God had forgotten them. And even if he hadn't, equally sure that his power, localized in the distant land of Judah, could not possibly do anything about the situation in far off Babylon. God was not dead, Yahweh was not dead for these people, he was simply impotent. A quaint anachronism, symbol of the good old days, who is remembered with nostalgia and homesickness. They were not theoretical atheists, they were practical atheists, convinced that God could no longer do anything about their situation. So some of them sat by the waters of Babylon and sang their sad songs, while others, encouraged by Jeremiah, made a go of it in this alien land, and sometimes it turned out to be a very prosperous go. But underneath it all was the restlessness, the uneasiness, the homesickness, all born of a lack of faith that Yahweh was still powerfully active in the world, or that he cared at all for what was going on in the world, and particularly in the world of the exile. Now, it seems to me this is a pretty fair picture of our contemporary situation. The rootlessness is evident in an age of mobility and devastatingly rapid change. In the disintegration of the family as an institution providing identity, security, and continuity. The ethical revolution with its resultant anomie or normlessness suggests God far off in time, symbol of the good old days. But deeper and far more pervading is the haunting fear that life today, like the life of the exiles, makes no sense. As Celia suggests, that would be terrible. It is. To what purpose God's long silence in Babylon, if he is a good and gracious God? To what purpose the suffering of children? So Camus, as the spokesman for the contemporary exile, declares, I share with you, you Christians, the same revulsion from evil, but I do not share your hope, and I continue to struggle against this universe in which children suffer and die. Now it is perhaps at this point of theodicy not as a rational explanation of the paradox of evil and the good and loving God, but theodicy is a term distinguishing the essential question at the root of human existence. At the focus of preaching is seen most sharply, in my understanding of it. So John Curtin and Murray, in The Problem of God, if God is, and if he is what he is, not only the creator but the pantocrator, how can the world be what it is, a place of manifold evil, an arena of human misery? Then he goes on, no man escapes this problem. It is put as a test to every man. The test is not put to man's intelligence, for unlike the metaphysical problem which admits a manner of philosophical resolution, the problem of evil utterly defeats philosophy. The test is put to man's freedom. The temptation is to reject the reality of God's presence in the world as its benevolent and provident ruler, in the rejection of the evil that is present with such dreadful reality. Man's questions here are not philosophical, but historical existential. Where is my God? Is he the living God or not? Richard R. Niebuhr comes to the same conclusion with respect to the central problem of men in our time. The question, he says, for faith and unbelief in our day is to wrestle with what some have called theodicy, and I call the logic of reconciliation to divine omnipotence and divine goodness. You see, how can a man be motivated to participate in God at work in the world, to use one of the most familiar phrases in renewal literature, until this basic question is dealt with honestly, candidly, over and over again? Professor Johannes Hockenbeck, the Dutch theologian now teaching at Union Seminary, calls this man of today with whom we have to do the fourth man, whose symbol is no longer Prometheus, the undaunted revolutionary who has dreamed up a new future for mankind and now is going to bring it about. A symbol, incidentally, assumed by so many of the optimistic readers of the secular age, a symbol very, very close to the hearts of a lot of the radical students who want to see change quickly and fast, with whom I come into contact. Prometheus is their symbol. Man can take the fire and do something with it, and quick. I suspect, however, that this is a minority over the entire country. And I suspect that Hockenbeck is right, that the symbol of the fourth man is Sisyphus, the hero of absurdity, who mockingly plods along, although he knows that the whole business does not contain a single promise. Now, I suspect you will probably not actually find an articulate fourth man in your churches engaged in prayer, praise, and listening to sermons. But I suspect that underneath the surface of your deacons and elders and church councilmen and a good many of the dear old ladies, you will find the lurking suspicion that the fourth man may have the right of it after all. I personally simply do not share Cox's view that the existentialist claim that our culture is meaningless or purposeless is simply wrong. And I find no hope in his assurance that our culture is a teleological or purpose-oriented culture and man is the fashioner of purpose. I simply cannot share his anthropological optimism. I believe that the old cliché, the age of anxiety, is still to be taken seriously. Scratch the surface of one of these apparently self-righteous, confident, purposeful Pharisees in our churches, and you find an anxious Pharisee. Scratch the surface of a narrow, prejudiced deacon, and you find a frightened deacon. Scratch the surface of a rebellious teenager, and more likely than not, you find a scared kid. I'm sure most of you have seen that TV documentary, A Time for Burning. If you recall, studies of Lutheran parish in Omaha, where the pastor attempted a minimal breakthrough with respect to the race problem by promoting interracial visits between members of his all-white congregation and a neighboring Negro Lutheran congregation. He failed until called upon to resign. But the camera made abundantly clear what the problem was. And the problem was fear on both sides. Now I grant you, the surface covering the fear may be made of pretty tough scratch-resistant material. And preaching has to take that into account, of course, as in Amos. And no doubt the man will resist with all his being having the surface scratched. The fear of what might happen were his insides exposed. What we're doing when we attempt to scratch the surface and attack the exposed nerve through the preaching of the law is to break through what may well be a lifetime of working out some M.O., to use TV jargon, some kind of modus operandi by which a man can come to some kind of terms with a rough, tough, competitive world that is impersonal, often brutal, and unbearably frightening. A world in which there is no observable ground of existence. There is no bottom anywhere, so far as he can see, for the only God visible to him has become the private deity of the church, and he meets him there. Not the God of grace, who is actively in control of this tough, brutal, and often frightening world. But the surface which covers up the heart of darkness, hard and impervious as it may be, necessary as it may be to deal with it on occasion, is not the basic problem. Sin is not pride or rebellion, essentially, or even sloth, as Harvey Cox so cogently suggests in his On Not Leaving It to the Snake. These are the cover-ups. These are the ways by which man takes matters into his own hands to come to terms with life when, because of his anxiety, he loses faith in God. Samuel Miller again throws further light on the contemporary situation. Few of us live in this age, or at least we live only partly in this age. Some of us are Paleolithic in art, Iron Age in politics, Victorian in morals, and only modern in the gadgets and plumbing we love in the cars we drive. There is some difficulty, he goes on, in moving entirely into the 20th century. We love so much that is no longer true of the world that we cannot bear to give up the fiction. And the question is, why cannot we bear to give up the fiction? So we return to the recurring theme in the renewal literature that the forms of the renewed life of the church must be permitted to grow around the shapes of world being. And I would most heartily agree that surely one of the major shapes of the world's needs is fear of change, fear of loss of meaning, fear of the fundamental uncertainty, which is the dominant mark of the 60s, the days in which you and I live. And the sermon, the preaching in the context of common worship, should be shaped around this overwhelming need, just as it was in the message of Second Isaiah, with its opening and predominant theme, comfort ye, my people. Colin Williams puts his finger on the throbbing need in a statement in What in the World? The church, he says, must seek to understand how we can speak to the need of man for a basic security from within which he can be free for change. Hear the once-for-all character of the gospel is vital, he says. We do witness to a Christ who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But so also he is the Christ who is bringing about revolutionary change as he brings to us the offer of participation in his future. The focus of preaching, therefore, will be to undergird constantly this fearful man of today with the assurance that God is, that God loves him. And in that context, calls him to participate in the life of the new being and the new society coming into being. For it is only as he recognizes that he is freed from his fears and deep-seated anxieties will he be free to answer the call to participation and involvement in this fast-changing world. Now again, let it be perfectly clear that preaching alone cannot bring this off. No single aspect or structure in the life of the church can enable a man to be free for change. He will need the support of a community of mutual concern. He will need opportunity for having questions discussed and possibly even answered. He will need to see that there is no comfort apart from claim. But as the community gathers for common worship, in that setting, the impact of the preaching will be predominantly gospel, assurance, hope. As Hogendyke emphasizes, the gospel that is preached must be made understandable as a message of hope. Sisyphus is the symbol of hopelessness. Here, hope will have to be learned again out of the bankruptcy of all human hope. In this situation, we may announce that for Christ's sake, the morning will come, that we can look forward to the morning and may expect much from it. Hope is here, he says, the liberating but strange message. So strange, says Puget somewhere in a moving poem, that God himself must be constantly amazed when people still can hope. Now the problem for the preacher, how to keep the focus of his preaching on assurance and hope without letting it drift into a vacuous purveil of cheap grace, the cult of cheap reassurance, a vapid peace of mind, and thus cut the artery of responsible response. Part of the answer will depend upon the fabric of the sermon, which I want to talk about tonight. But in addition, the preacher, sensitive to the basic human situation, as I've tried to set it forth here, will also recognize that biblical hope has its roots in the bankruptcy of all merely human hope. Thus, while undergirding modern man's need for assurance, he will also be conscious of the necessity of exposing all false hopes and proximate securities as the idols that they are. that's not as easy as it sounds. Preaching that is focused upon the biblical hope will not be toothless. It will not be easy to listen to. What we're attempting to stress here is the underlying groundswell of preaching today, its ultimate theme or focus, rather than the thrust of some particular sermon, which may well be devastating rather than reassuring in its immediate impact, or the devastating accuracy with which the preacher reflects the contemporary situation, whether in suburbia, small town, or inner city, to which the gospel of hope is addressed. Meanwhile, if the fourth man is lurking beneath the surface of the people in our congregations, harboring the suspicion that all life has to say ultimately is no, then it is rarely called Joseph Sittler's pregnant phrase. Ultimate negations, he says, ultimate negations generate a strange addressability to ultimate affirmation. He then illustrates the point by reference to Salinger's Holden Caulfield in the Roxy Gallery, watching the Rockettes make their peculiar obeisance to the Incarnation in a tinsel Christmas routine. You may recall how the boy, lonely and honest amidst the gurgling delight of the audience, remarked, "Good old Jesus would appear." It may very well be, you see, that the man of today, reflected in so much contemporary literature, sees more clearly than we do the inadequacy of our celebration of the Christ event, and thereby reveals his openness to its actual depth. This at least is a ray of hope on the horizon of preaching fallen into decay, and may give added zest to Paul's familiar lines, "The night is far spent, the day is at hand, for now is your salvation nearer than when you believed." Thank you very much. the basic practical requirement is identification with the people so that you actually know what's going on inside of them, what makes them tick. And this takes time, and I have a whole lecture on the identification of the man with the people. You must be aware of the screen that shields us simply because we are theological students or ordained ministers, between us and people whom we think we know quite well. And it is somehow through our identification with these people, our living with them in a natural way, to catch the language they use, the questions they really ask, which are not the questions, in other words, it's to try to listen to the questions underneath the questions they're asking us. Let me give you just a simple example. We've been living up in a summer community up in northern Vermont, and I've been there for about 12 years now. My brother has been there considerably longer. My brother is a lawyer, and his neighbor is a farmer who has the richest, purposed vocabulary you ever heard in all your life. Every other word is a four-letter word, and it is rich and voluble and comes out all the time. He calls me Ed. He knows me by first name. I am intimate with him to that degree. He's a good friend, accepts me for what I am, and so on. I have never heard that vocabulary. He turns it off, just as valuable, because I am a minister. This is a superficial example of the way people turn themselves off or turn off parts of their lives when we come to God. And this involvement, I think part of it may come about in terms of theological training. We are experimenting at Union with putting men into Bill Weber's MUST program, in which instead of going through this academic world into the theological seminary, they break it off after college and just throw them to work for a year in the city. Not necessarily in Harlem. Some of them work in Harlem, some of them work in Madison Avenue, all over the place. Just simply to find out what it's like to be a layman. This is a constructive, programmatic way of attempting to do this. The other is simply by trying to inform and sensitize yourself to what's going on. It's a big obstacle in our way, no question about it. Thank you. carry the towel, say, away with all preaching. Inevitably, you won't hear much time, but you will have to support a cause, and you will have to put it. Recognizing the fact that we must be very careful, I know that the giving will be great, all the time to do is to nurture. It's an overstatement. I just feel very strongly about this, and I think that when it comes to supporting drives, supporting movements, supporting institutions, that we ought to use other structures in the church other than the sermon for this. That's really what I'm saying. Obviously, we have to talk about the place of the church in the community, its responsibilities, and so on and so forth. But when I started my radio preaching, it was fantastic how few of those sermons I could use in a radio situation, because they were so institutionally centered. Without my being aware of it, I was constantly talking about our church and the need for people in the choir and all kinds of stuff like that. And all of a sudden my eyes were open. What have you been doing in your preaching? Are you really dealing with the problems, the basic problems of life and death, of faith and love and hope with these people, week after week after week? Or are you simply trying to nurture an institution? I mean, I agree, sir, it's an overstatement, but I think we ought to take a very, very harsh look at it.
One more.